I'm joined now by Michael Hollinger, the author of Tooth and Claw, Opus, Incorruptible, and many other works for stage and screen. He is currently an associate professor of theater at Villanova University and an alumnus playwright at New Dramatists in New York City. Michael Hollinger, welcome to LA Theater Works, and thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Susan.
Tell us about the origins of Tooth and Claw. How did you become aware of the subject matter, and how did you begin to fashion it into a story?
Well, I heard an NPR story. It must have been around 1994, 95, so we're going back a long time. And the news story was very striking because in the story, it was telling about how native fishermen in the Galapagos Islands, resisting new constraints placed on their fishing of sea cucumbers, had taken to slaughtering giant tortoises, which are endangered and protected in the islands, in order to make their case. In other words, in order to try to preserve their right to continue fishing sea cucumbers. The story immediately struck me with the irony that here was a species, if you will, adapting in order to survive in the islands where Darwin first began to assemble his ideas regarding natural selection. And so I thought, well, this is an incredible collision of forces. And as a playwright, I'm always attracted to collisions of forces. What made it increasingly interesting for me is that as I began to look into the story, I realized that the director of the Charles Darwin Research Station in Galapagos, really the head guardian of the ecological preserve, was an American woman. In fact, the only woman, I believe, who's ever been the director of the research station to date. And something about the dynamic of a woman in the middle of a very male culture, particularly involved in rather violent conflicts here, that attracted me and interested me. So I began doing research, and this being the mid-90s, I was, you know, not just Googling things. I was going to libraries, and I was digging up magazine articles and tracking down NPR transcripts and things. It was quite laborious.
And then you traveled to the Galapagos Islands to research the play.
Well, that was the lucky break because a foundation called the Independence Foundation, based in Philadelphia, began an independent artist fellowship program, encouraging artists to pursue projects that might be costly for them. And this was exactly the project I knew I needed to submit because I knew that the situation in Galapagos was so complex economically and culturally that I needed to go there and interview people. I needed to interview fishermen and interview scientists and see the islands and see the wildlife in order to begin to appreciate the complexities of these situations. So that was the great gift that allowed me to really launch it.
So for our listeners who are unfamiliar, exactly where are the islands located? And tell us some of your impressions and experiences there.
They're part of Ecuador, and they're about 100 miles west of South America, right at the equator. So some of the Galapagos Islands are fall south of the equator and some north of the equator. It is an astonishing archipelago. It's volcanic, and some of the islands, which are newer, are extremely stark. They look like a kind of moonscape. And others, which are older, are rather verdant, you know, lots of trees and grasses and plant life. Seeing the creatures that evolved there, birds that swim in the water, cormorants who swim but have forgotten how to fly because they never had to, iguanas who swam to survive and so are ocean-going, and hosts of other creatures that are endemic to the Galapagos and nowhere else in the world. This, for me, was like meeting celebrities. I'd read all about these creatures and to suddenly look over and say, it's a blue-footed booby. Oh my gosh. There's a whole host of boobies, which is a kind of bird that you'll find in Galapagos. And these particular types that I've mentioned are all endemic to Galapagos. But it's astonishing because a lot of places, these creatures have no particular defenses that you would notice. You could walk on an island covered with boobies and just go over and step on them if you wanted to, because human beings hadn't been around when they evolved their defense skills, so there's no reason for them to be frightened of a person walking on two legs. It's really astonishing.
Did you get to meet the real Lonesome George?
I did, yes. I didn't get to kind of sit with him because he's in a rather large corral, so you can see him a little bit of a distance. He was... God rest his soul. But, you know, you can be very close to a lot of the tortoises that are at the Darwin Research Station. And Lonesome George is, you know, was a legitimate celebrity there, really a poster child for Galapagos. His image was on all the publicity and the logos and that sort of thing.
How big was he?
He was about the size of these larger tortoises. They go into the hundreds of pounds. I wouldn't be able to identify George particularly. Again, I saw him a little bit of a distance, but gosh, what do you compare it to? They're about the size of an armchair if you turned it over on its side.
When you created the character of Schuyler Baines, how close was she to the real woman or what you knew about the real woman?
Well, I did track down the actual scientist who was directing the station at the time, and she was very gracious in giving me all kinds of information, both anecdotal information and video and audio and photographs to kind of let me understand what this was like. A lot of the anecdotes that show up in the play were things that were from her experience in terms of the incidents around this play in particular. But as a dramatist, I changed a lot, too. I created a character who was single, which is not true of the real-life scientist.
What was her name?
Oh, Chantal Blanton is the actual scientist. She had, by the time I started working on the play, she had retired from the station. And the character in my play has recently lost her mother, who was a noteworthy scientist, in a sense whose shadow she's been living under for a long time as a scientist. So I think that sense of biological legacy is in the play. A woman who has just lost her mother and who is at a point where if she herself is going to pass on genes, it's going to be now. And who has a lot of aspirations within her field. She has high ideals. These are characteristics that I didn't borrow from Chantal. I didn't sense that this was anything that was haunting her.
The play incorporates a popular scientific parable written by Dr. Seuss. What influence do you think Dr. Seuss has had on generations of young scientists?
That's a wonderful question. Well, it's funny. A lot of the Dr. Seuss books I started paying more attention to as I had young children. And you read a lot of books when you have young children. And the good ones you're pleased to read over and over again. And the bad ones you kind of wish would go away. And the Dr. Seusses kept coming up. And as I read them over and over again, I started to realize what a kind of intense love of diversity is in them, a love of, you know, the variety of creatures. And he's made most of them up in some of these books. But I do think that a sense of reverence for nature and a sense of wonderment, and I'm not speaking only of books like the Lorax book, which is overtly ecological, but the book that turns up in the play, One Fish, Two Fish, Red Fish, Blue Fish, which on the surface is so simple as to seem silly, but when you look at it in terms of evolution, is kind of startling.
Tooth and Claw takes what could be a very strident subject and humanizes it. What is the key to writing about complex environmental and social issues without simply standing on a soapbox?
Well, I think this is why I felt I knew I needed to go to Galapagos. When I traveled there, the play in my head was a very one-sided one, ecologists good, fishermen bad. And I think I knew that in order to find the gray between these poles, I needed to travel there. So I interviewed fishermen, I interviewed all kinds of people on the islands and scientists. And what I discovered and learned as I went along was that everybody wanted what they wanted a lot. And I began to respect the particular economic imperatives that the locals had. I began to meet the types of people who were later on to show up in the play, so I felt like I could start to legitimately give voice to their perspectives. And then at the same time, I started to realize, well, you know, even the highest idealed ecologist is driven by forces that he or she may not understand, personal reasons. And so it allowed me to, which is, I think, the key to it, is to find the flaw in the hero and to find the nobility in the nemesis until you realize that, in fact, these forces are quite complex, which is where the play wants to live.
I was very moved and interested by the relationship between Schuyler and the man who really is her father. At the end of the play, you never bring it this out in the open. he never tells her that he's her father. It felt to me like there was a silent acknowledgement on her part that she knew when she asks him if he could be her surrogate father. But what did she really mean? So I wanted to know what your intention was.
Well, you've sort of nailed exactly what my intentions were. Because Malcolm, the older man, was sworn to secrecy about being her father, and because her mother has died, he felt as though it's not a thing that he could do outright. And Skylar's savvy enough to know that if he's a discreet person, that she wouldn't come out and ask him. I think beyond that, though, that they recognize on some level that there's a spiritual connection that is not enhanced by declaring it. In a sense, for her to say, I've never known my father, but I'd like to imagine he was someone like you.
hint,
is a way of saying, let's be father and daughter now, and we don't have to make that official. But that groundwork has already been laid by a kind of spiritual communion that they've discovered. I think that I'm very intrigued by what manifests itself spiritually between people in an almost invisible way versus what our culture says. Here's what this relationship is.
Well, Michael Hollinger, thank you so much for speaking with us today. This was very interesting.
It was a great treat. Thank you.
I've been speaking with playwright Michael Hollinger, the author of Tooth and Claw,